Pierre Robert on 93.3 WMMR, and our guest this afternoon is one of the more colorful characters in rock and roll. He's not just rock and roll, though. He's an American entertainer, an activist for peace, some might say the oldest hippie, but he's really actually done some incredibly serious work through the years that's helped a lot of people, including co-founding several organizations like Camp Win a Rainbow, the Siva Foundation, the Hog Farm Activist Commune. Also, he was the official clown of the Grateful Dead. How one gets that, one wonders. There's also a documentary on his life. It's called Saint Misbehavin', the Wavy Gravy Movie. He's written a few books. He's in our area to celebrate his 80th birthday. It's a weekend-long, unlimited devotion celebration, and it includes an evening of goodness at the Mainline Arts Center in Haverford. That will be tonight. There'll also be on display an extensive Grateful Dead poster collection, and Splintered Sunlight will play. Then on Saturday night, the Ardmore Music Hall hosts a benefit concert for the Rex Foundation with some incredibly talented players, and I suspect some Grateful Dead music will be played. And he was, of course, one of the announcers. He's been to all three Woodstocks, but he was one of the announcers on stage at the original in 1969. And I, for one, being only in eighth grade, seeing the film in a movie theater going, "Oh my God, that looks like Utopia," will never forget the line where he said, "What we have in
mind." Good morning! What we have in mind is breakfast in bed for $400,000, which was picked by Entertainment Weekly as one of the top entertainment lines of the 20th century.
Really? Wow.
Who'd thunk it? It just popped out of my head. I didn't think it, or there was no thought. Thinking gets in the way of thought.
It certainly can. And with that in mind, it's such a pleasure to welcome to WMMR Hugh Nanton Romney, so much better known as Wavy Gravy. Good day, sir.
You have some gravy in your ear, perhaps a Q-tip.
You're wearing a nice rainbow peace sign shirt, which is awesome.
It matches my teeth, which is a rainbow bridge.
Oh, my God, it really is. You have rainbow-colored teeth.
Neil Cassidy took me to this dentist in Santa Cruz. Neil's dentist. You'd know if he can get his hands in and out of Neil's mouth without getting them chewed off, it's got to be an awesome dentist. So I came in to get some fake teeth, and the TV was on. It was during Vietnam. The body count was high, and I was furious. I said in a loud voice, "The only flag I want to salute is a rainbow." And the dentist secretly made up a rainbow bridge. Got on the bus. I'm in a body cast from my nipples to my knees. It was painted blue with stars. It was the all-star cast. And he stuck this rainbow in my mouth. And that original rainbow is now residing in Cleveland in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This is number 3 I'm wearing now.
What were you in the body cast for?
I got beat up a lot by the police and the National Guard for protesting against the genocide, shall we say, across the Great Water.
Wow. Well, let's start with the dead posters that are going to be on display. And Scott, why don't you come over here to the microphone for a moment and tell us who you are and what these dead posters are all about.
Well, my name's Scott Shapiro, and I own 82 original Grateful Dead posters. Mixed in with that is a few... actually original Herbie Green photographs.
Wow.
That I've been fortunate enough to get to know Herbie over the years, so some friends have bought
Tell
some.
Folks who Herbie is.
Herbie was, I guess, one of the original photographers that lived in and around the Grateful Dead back when they were in the Haight in the 65, 66, 67. So the very famous photographs you see of the band sitting on the steps
Wow.
are Herbie's photographs. The first the first Dead concert at the Avalon, where they take, it's a black and white poster where they have a photograph of Jerry wearing a leather jacket, is a Herbie Green photograph. So over the last 20 years or so, mostly my father-in-law has, on holidays and birthdays and whatnot, has purchased for me, instead of buying shirts and scarves and gloves and whatnot, has purchased for me posters. He appreciated my love for the band, and he got to know the artistic side of the Grateful Dead, the poster side, as well as I did. And each year, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 different posters would come my way. And now over 20 years, it's become quite a substantial collection. So I, back in November, I met up with a friend of mine who lives in the neighborhood, and she introduced me to Wavy's daughter-in-law, who happens to be the executive director of the Mainline Arts Center. And during a little meeting, breakfast meeting in my office, she looked at her friend Wendy and said, "Have you told him?" And they both smiled and looked at me, and she said to me, "I just want you to know that my father-in-law is wavy gravy."
Wow.
And I can't repeat exactly what I said at the time, but once we realized that Wavy was interested in coming and supporting this event, we could celebrate his 80th birthday, the whole idea of the fundraiser really started to gain some traction, and it happens tonight. So it's going to be incredible. We have at least 200 people coming. We still have tickets available.
How do you get tickets?
You get tickets at unlimiteddevotion.eventbrite, one word, B-R-I-T-E, .com. If you just Google Unlimited Devotion, at this point, we're kind of all over the place. And then on Saturday at the Bryn Mawr Film Institute, we have a showing of Michelle Esrick's film, Saint Misbehavin', which is, I've seen it, it's absolutely spectacular.
What time does the film show?
The film starts at 11 a.m., and it runs until about 12:30 p.m., and then Wavy's going to be there for a Q&A.
Cool. With Mrs. Gravy, too.
Michelle, cool. Mrs. Gravy will be there. Jordan, Wavy's son, will be there. It's really, you can't miss. It should be extraordinary.
That's awesome. The posters are not going to be for sale, right? They're just for display.
No, none of my posters are for sale. What I did is I hired a longtime artist from the Grateful Dead community, a guy named Tony Rionegro. Tony's dad used to be a sound engineer, and whenever the Dead came to New York, Tony was a kid at the time, but his dad was there to repair instruments, equipment, and whatnot. And so Tony became very familiar with the band, and as he got older, he became an artist, and he started designing all the backstage passes. So the pass that Wavy's wearing today is a pass that Tony designed for us.
Wow.
And I've hired him to actually paint an original poster, and we're going to auction off that painting for charity.
Oh, nice.
For the Rex Foundation.
So again, just repeat quickly the events and their order and their times.
Okay, so tonight, June 10th, beginning at 6 p.m. at the Mainline Arts Center, tickets are available at unlimiteddevotion.eventbrite.com. Then Saturday morning, June 11th.
How late does it run tonight?
It'll run until about 10 p.m.
Okay.
And then Saturday morning, tomorrow, the 11th, at 11 a.m. And then tomorrow evening, doors open at 7:38 at the Ardmore Music Hall. We have a concert scheduled that we're working in cooperation with Chris Perella over at the Ardmore Music Hall. And we have Mark Caron, the Butchie Band.
Wow.
Graham Lesh.
Son of Phil, by the way.
Son of Phil. Kenny Brooks is coming down, formerly of the Rat Dog Band, and the Terrapin Family All-Stars.
Cool.
So we have a full night of music.
They're going to cover Lawrence Welk, I understand.
Turn off the bubble machine.
It should be, for me, it's a dream come true. And spending the day with Wavy is just unbelievable.
That's
just
excellent.
Spectacular.
The whole thing is called Unlimited Devotion. Thank you, Scott.
Sure, my pleasure.
So back to our conversation with Wavy Gravy. It was interesting because Scott, in one interview I read with him, described you, Wavy, as one of life's greatest gifts. I thought that was a cool tribute.
Hippie icon, flower geezer, and temple of accumulated error.
Now, but you're so in present time as well. I saw a great picture your manager Mark just put out the other day of you somewhere with Paul Simon and the two
snuggling at the Greek Theater.
Was that where it was?
It was, yes. And we had a full half hour snuggle after the show. You've heard the album, of course.
Yeah.
It's so good. It is so good. I am just tingling all over from how good that record is. And he's never hit a bad note in 20 years. I mean, just from when he went to embracing the African stuff and taking that and lifting it
Graceland,
up.
Graceland, yeah.
Oh, a masterpiece.
His music is so universal that there's a heavy metal band we play called Disturbed. And, I mean, they are hard rock, heavy metal, and they have just covered and have a huge hit right now with Sound of Silence.
Oh,
it speaks to the universal nature of music, that it crosses all these boundaries. It's what I always say. This radio station's been here since 1968. We are, and Pancake showed you in the hallway, we are one of only two radio stations that advertised in the original Woodstock book.
I have that book.
Do you really?
Yes.
You have the whole book?
Yes.
Well, so if you look back on it.
I used to have like 50 of them.
Wow. I'd love to have one. But if you look back through it, you'll see the advertisement for WMMR. So we've been on the air, as we like to say, one of the few stations that was playing the White Album when it was new. But we've always continued to play new music along the line, too, which is how I think it should be, a balance
Excellent.
Of old and new.
Absolutely.
So when you...
Eternity now.
Yeah, well, so when you hang out with Paul Simon, and yet I talked to David Draiman, the singer of this metal band called Disturbed, and asked him if he had heard from Paul Simon, and he goes, yes, because it doesn't really sound much like the original, and yet you can hear the original and the inspiration. It just speaks to how music grows.
And Paul is certainly ready for evolution of his tunes.
Now, I got to go back to your early history. Is it true that you took a walk around the block with Albert Einstein?
First of all, I was 5. Second of all, before I went for a walk, when I was 3, my parents bundled me up and took me in the mountains because the Martians were coming.
Oh.
This was Orson Welles, War of the Worlds. But everybody believed it, man. They took their children in the cars and went out into the wilderness to avoid the Martians. Now, my mom would put me in the yard when I was 5. I was kind of stinky. And to air me, she put me in the yard, and I was right in Albert Einstein's flight path. He was teaching at Princeton. We lived in Princeton right by the university. And he used to like look at me and twinkle, and he just asked my mom if he could go around the block with me. So she was like, you know, her whelm was over. So all I remember is a shock of white hair that predated Don King by half a century. A twinkle in his eyes, no logos, and a peculiar odor. You remember smells when you're young.
Yes.
Way back in your infancy, you remember how things smelled. And I've never smelled anything like that before or since. But someday, I'll be walking down the street and suddenly... Hey, man, you smell like Albert Einstein. Someday.
Oh, my God. You also hung out with Dylan in the very early days in the village, right?
I remember when Bob first came into the Gaslight, he was wearing Woody Guthrie's underwear. I'm not making this up.
Seriously.
He had just visited Woody in the hospital in Long Island and snatched some underwear. He was a devoted Woody file, and he came into the Gaslight, and it was a hootenanny. He said, hey, can I go on? And I just grabbed the mic. I said, here he is, a legend in his lifetime. What's your name, kid?
No. You didn't even know his name?
No.
But wow.
I just said that, and we ended up sharing a room up over the Gaslight. In fact, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall was written on my typewriter.
Come on.
I used to have the original draft. It was eaten by a Beacons along with Lenny Bruce's couch. They had a fire.
Eaten by what?
A Beacon storage thing. They had a fire in there, and I lost. And a beautiful kind of like velvet couch that Lenny adored. And Lenny was my manager for a while when I was doing stand-up.
That's a wildest thing, Lenny Bruce. What would be a piece of advice you hold today to be dear that he gave you?
Well... Always speak the truth. Mm-hmm. Lenny spoke the truth like no other, and that's why what his brilliance was. And they destroyed him with nothing. Everything that he was charged with, all these, and they started busting not only Lenny, but the club owners. So it became more and more difficult for Lenny to get work until he couldn't get any work at all. And after his passing, he was cleared of every charge in every state that he was being battered. It was horrific.
That is very sad. We're speaking with the one and only Wavy Gravy on 93.3 WMMR. There's a wonderful event this weekend. It is called Unlimited Devotion, with all kinds of cool artwork, and we'll tell you more about it as we continue. I want to, and must for a brief moment, I don't know, are you weary of talking about Woodstock? Does it
no,
bother
no,
you?
No. You want Woodstock? I'll give you Woodstock.
Listen
to this. Here we go. Ready, set?
I don't think I even need to ask any questions.
One, two, three. Okay. We were in New York City, the Cement Apple, looking to evacuate. We being this commune called the Hog Farm, we got six buses and a pig. Her name was Figasus.
Serious?
She was the first pig? Female black and white candidate that we ran for president. She got a lot of votes.
Wait a minute. Is this a real pig?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm just checking.
We're the Hog Farm, man. We started.
Who knows what you were smoking back then? I want to make sure this is an accurate memory or not something that was had colors attached to it.
We can smoke and play with pigs. It's not that.
So you guys moved out west and then were called back, right?
Here's the deal. We were in New York City, actually, looking to evacuate. Cities should be built on one side of the street, said Bob Kaufman, and we were heeding his advice. And we were staying at this loft in New York, a full city block. And we're around this enormous kitchen table when this guy comes in looking like Allen Ginsberg on a Dick Gregory diet. And he says, how would you guys like to do this music festival in New York State? And we said, well, look, we're going to be in New Mexico on the Dizuki Indian Reservation for the summer solstice. He says, that's all right. We'll fly you in an Astro jet. And we figured he was one toke over the line, man. This guy, right, an Astro jet. He's going to fly us in. We end up on the Tizuki Indian Reservation. Here's this guy, and he's got this aluminum briefcase like the high-end rock and rollers tend to sport, and he pops it open, and inside is the tree flesh that indeed we have our own American Airlines Astrojet to take 85 of us and 15 Indians to the Cement Apple. And we get off the plane, and here is the world press and cameras and all that stuff. And, oh, the Hog Farm, huh? You guys are doing this security. I said, my God, they made us the cops. I said, well, do you feel secure? The guy says, yeah. I said, well, see, it's working. He said, come on, what are you going to use for crowd control? And I said, cream pies and seltzer bottles. And they all wrote it down.
Oh, my God.
They all wrote it down. And actually, in Texas, those pies materialized. But that's another story.
Now, you were called the Police Force.
Yes. Yes, we were the police force. I was the police chief. The password was I forgot.
But, I mean, because the idea was that you were going to treat everyone gently.
Yes.
So please don't stand there. Please get off the towers. Please this.
And how did I get on a microphone is I was spotted by my friend E.H. Beresford Monk, otherwise known as Chipmunk, who invented concert lighting in the Village Gate, was the road manager for the Rolling Stone, and built the stage at Woodstock. And he was aware of Hugh Romney doing my tongue dance in coffee houses and knew I could get on a microphone and say hospital and people wouldn't immediately go break a leg. But they'd know that this was a safe, comfortable place that they could go to. So what I got to do is life support announcements. I never introduced a band, but I told them where to go to the bathroom, and if you're having some trouble with psychotropic substances, we had a station for that. We called it the Trip Tent.
The Trip Tent.
Yes, and we would deal with. I remember when the first freakout came into the freakout tent. He's going, Miami Beach, 1944, Joyce, Joyce. And this 300-pound Australian doctor laid down on top and says, body contact. You need body contact. And the guy's going, Miami Beach. And this psychiatrist leans in and says, just think of your third eye, man. And they go, Miami Beach. I said, excuse me, I'd like to try something. They all backed up. What's this hippie going to do? And I lean in and I say, what's your name, man?
Miami B.
What's your name, man? Bob. Your name is Bob. And you can see he really likes that. The lost hotels float out of his eyes. I reinforce, your name is Bob. Your name is Bob. Guess what, Bob? What? You've taken a little acid and it's going to wear off. Thank you. But when he was near normal and ready to rock and roll, we said, whoa, see that sister coming through the door with her toes in her nose? That was you 4 hours ago. Now you're the doctor. Take over. And that way the scene regenerated itself. Like the Free Kitchen, when Life magazine took the photograph of our Free Kitchen, we were all passed out in the bushes. It was all volunteers.
Now, I have to ask you, because I've seen the movie a million times, and as I told you, when I was like in eighth grade, growing up in Northern California, and seeing that movie, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is utopia, naked people having sex in the woods, and swimming in the ponds, and watching these amazing bands mm-hmm. play. But you're on that stage. What was the view like? What did you see when you looked out at that crowd?
Infinity.
Dig infinity!
But your take on it, as you
remember it. It was a magnificent buzz. I mean, I was just engulfed by the buzz. I was super wavy.
You been doing any substances yourself?
One or two, but I discovered that I was being amazing. And the minute I said, ooh, look at me, I'm amazing, I'd fall on my butt in the mud. But if I just flowed with it and did stuff, it was to be amazing with the vibe. Just surrendering to that vibe of Woodstock, that the powers that be, the spiritual wooga wooga, wanted this thing to transpire. And we were implements in making that occur.
Now, what about backstage? Because people, Bill Graham was legendary for creating these elaborate backstages, which was much later, obviously. But what was the backstage area, such as it was, like, and who might you see hanging out there?
Well, Bill had nothing to do with it. He brought in Santana. They got, I think, $500 because he came in late. The Who and Jimi Hendrix got all the money. Huh. So a lot of other people came in with, no money. But they ended up in the film and they became like people like Country Joe.
Right.
He had his whole life paid for it with that one song.
Feel like I'm fixing to die.
Yeah.
Or Arlo Guthrie coming into Los Angeles.
Yes, he was.
But some of the lines, like where Arlo says, hey, I was talking to the fuzz, man.
Yeah.
And New York State Thruway is closed. That line.
No, then he goes, hey. Yeah. There's that crackle at the end.
And he goes, a lot of freaks. And then, there's a line, I think it was you that said, hey, if you're too tired to chew, pass it on. Was that you?
No, but I said, if it's not bad acid, just been manufactured poorly.
The brown acid, right?
If you have any doubts about the acid, give it to the guy who sold it to you and see what he does.
Oh, my God. So in terms of that backstage again, though, was there a backstage where you might run into Hendrix or Janis Joplin or The Who?
But we were too busy for that, really.
I
did get to hear Jimmy do the Star Spangled
Banner. You did.
Let me tell you something. At Camp Winter Rainbow, I have kids from 7 to 14. That's our age limit. And at the last morning of the session, we wake them up with Jimmy playing the Star Spangled Banner.
Wow.
Full blast on the sound system from the Meyer Sound and Grateful Dead. And these kids levitate and they run out of their teepees and have a pillow fight.
Wow.
No headshots.
Okay.
And no tears, but it's magnificent. And I think that Jimmy smiles down on us every time we have that pillow fight.
I interviewed John Entwistle of The Who, and he said mm-hmm. he had come there, and everything was running so late, and they didn't get on until early morning, I guess.
And that's right.
He had someone offered him some punch, and he had it, and then went walking around in the audience and realized it was electric punch, quite spiked, and having all these bizarre adventures, and somehow finding his way to the backstage in time. And then later at some motel relatively near to there, he woke up with this woman peering in the window, and it happened to be Janis Joplin. Stories like that just like floor me. But the last thing I want to ask about Woodstock is Max Yasgur. He was the farm. Mm-hmm. That was the farm it was held upon. And
yes.
He was the guy who spoke those amazing words. You kids have proven something to the world. Did you get a chance to chat with him or get a vibe from him?
Here's the deal. This is good. Mark, you never even heard this. We created a bulletin board at Woodstock. I love bulletin boards, putting up. And we cut a hole in the bulletin board so you could stick your head in the bulletin board and make a living announcement. And I happened to stick my head in the bulletin board to announce a baby race. We had a frog race at Woodstock, in New Mexico. So we decided to duplicate the frog race with babies. And they would start in the middle and and who did I stick my, who was right there was Max Yasker. And he brought his family to the baby race and fell in love with the hog farm and would send us buckets of beautiful yogurt every morning.
Wow.
He was a dear, sweet man.
I understand the neighbors, his neighbors grew to hate him because of the madness that the festival caused.
Yeah, but then, you know, time went by and they grew to love him.
I always wanted to make a pilgrimage to the original site. There is now a performing center there.
Yeah, a museum.
Yeah. But anyway, Woodstock's so fascinating. But you're so fascinating on so many levels. By the way, you also
and
went
by
to...
By the way, Woodstock was 70 miles from the site of Bethel and White Lake where the event took place. They would not... They freaked right. out at the idea of having it in Woodstock. They could not deal.
Right. You went to Woodstock 2 and 3, which I find cool, and some of the effort...
First one made me famous, the second two got me paid.
Well, that's fair enough. You know, Graham Nash, who you know and who yes. I know, has a button that says, I don't remember Woodstock, but Crosby, Stills, and Nash were asked, and some of the artists were asked to come back to Woodstock 2, having had that cosmic experience in the movie theaters mm-hmm. with Woodstock 1, but not being there. I made a pilgrimage to take my program here up there and broadcast live from there.
Wow.
And it was, you know, to me, it was great fun, and there was, you know, it was on a real farm, and it was muddy, you know, and I think that's where, because you're known for these wonderful bands from the 60s, but that's where you got to know Green Day, right?
Not only that, it just rained a little bit, and he says, I bet you idiots can't hit us with any mud. And everybody reached out and grabbed a handful. After 2 minutes, you could plant rutabagas on the stage, man. Everybody was covered with mud. Poor Mike Dent was being beat by security because they thought he came out of the mosh pit. He's the bass player, I said. He's the bass player.
Oh, that's priceless.
Oh,
that's on the video of Woodstock 2. That's one of the great moments, the mud fight between Green Day and the audience back and forth. And many people thought they, in some ways, stole the show.
And I had my black light underwear on and my my Timberline boots. And he says, that's Wavy Gravy. He's a real punk rocker.
Billy Joe said that?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
What a compliment that was. I just lit up. Yeah, okay.
See, that represents so much of today's artistry, and because you're, again, identified with those older bands, like I said, MMR's been playing new music all through the years, that is still one of the premier artists of the day, Green Day, the Foo Fighters, the Killers, bands of that ilk.
Elvis Costello sang What's So Funny About Love, Peace, and Understanding for me.
At the second one.
Somebody threw a bottle of water at me, and I caught it in midair and said, don't throw stuff at me, I'm an old guy.
But have you stayed in touch, like, with Green Day?
Absolutely. Trey Cool's kid goes to camp with a rainbow.
Nice.
Absolutely.
What other artists that you discovered at either Woodstock 2 or 3 that are of a newer nature did you get turned on to and still like today?
Well, name somebody.
Well, it got...
My chromosomes have amnesia.
The Offspring were there. I can't think of them now that you're asking me.
Me either.
Peppers, obviously, were at the second one. Peter Gabriel.
Ooh, Peter Gabriel is a sweet man, but ooh, I got so mad at Limp Bizkit and
all right,
Fred
so
Durst. Here's the deal.
But wait a
Here's
minute. You
deal.
Have a different memory than
Let's
I do.
Let's go Woodstock 3.
well,
okay.
Let me stop
People
you.
Are raging about $5 water. They don't mention the free water that came out of the tap.
Well, wait, let me stop you, though, because Woodstock 3 I went to also. And first of all, it wasn't on a farm. It was on an old Air Force base on an airport.
Yes.
And with
yes.
you know, and that was a little iffy. One stage on
yes.
one side, one stage on the other. The last band was supposed to be the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and they were supposed to be a 10-minute tribute to Jimi Hendrix. At the end of it, one of the promoters, John Scher, is my memory. Yours is different about
Rock
Limp Bizkit.
Rock and roll Hitler.
But John Scher, one of the promoters, came on stage and said... he stopped the Peppers. In fact, they were playing. He goes, listen, there's a fire out there. Don't pay any attention to it. We've called the authorities. And with that, all everyone heard was fire. And then the Peppers went into fire. And then other fires started going. And then it got out of control. That's my memory of it.
No. Fred Durst says, go destroy stuff. It's good for you.
Oh, he did say
yes,
that.
Yes. Meanwhile, I had said goodbye to my friends Indigenous. They were playing a tribute, a blues tribute, and I said, I'm wasted. The thing is over. I'm going to the hotel. I turned on the TV and I saw the fire.
The whole idea of having it on an old Air Force base didn't.
No, what's the band Page? Famous rock and rollers of today that does them on Air Force fields all the time. Come on.
Well, Metallica played there.
No, a hippie band.
Fish.
They do airfields all the time. It's wonderful. It's flat. You're going to trip in the mud. They got facilities. They got bathrooms. They got everything. Excuse me. I thought it was just fine to do it on an airfield.
Okay. Do you think there should be another one, or should they let it go at that? There's so many festivals now.
Well, in 3 years, the gravy sock is going to go through the ceiling because Woodstock will be 50. They love that stuff. Every time there's a decade. 40, yeah! 45, not so much. 50, whoa!
So you think there could be one?
There could be something. But I will hear from Michael Lang, who is a good friend of mine.
He was the promoter and seen often in the film.
We call him Curly.
Curly,
and he still has the locks.
That's cool.
And he's a dear, sweet man, and I would travel anywhere for Michael.
One last thing in that vicinity of time. I was communicating with Graham Nash and said how excited I was that you were coming in. And he said, ask Wavy about the time where he called me to come to Chicago during the Democratic National Convention in 68. And he asked if CSNY, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, would come there to raise money. Do you recall that?
Absolutely. And David and Graham wanted to come. And YNN were not that interested.
Stills
so,
and Young.
So Graham wrote that beautiful song.
It's called Chicago.
And it's actually dedicated to me if you look at the liners for that.
He speaks of you in his solo acoustic show, which he's out doing now, and just lovingly he speaks of you. He's one of the nicest guys.
I adore Graham.
In rock and roll.
He's a sweetheart.
They say that Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters is kind of a similar person in today's world.
I hear tell.
Yeah. Is there any young band that you'd like to see, like the Foo Fighters or Killers?
I just enjoy anything. I'd like to see Dead & Company.
Oh, that's another question I was going to ask you. So, obviously, you knew Jerry.
Yes.
They've carried on, more on that in a moment, but they've carried on in various incarnations since his passing. They tried a tour as the Other Ones. Then they went out as just the Dead, not the Grateful Dead. Then that splintered into different groups, Phil and Friends, and then Bob and Phil got together at various times, and they called it Further. And then
Further was nice.
Yeah, well, and then last summer were three nights in Chicago, and I went to the last one where it was again called The Grateful Dead and said to be the final Grateful Dead shows because Phil was going to do his last with Mickey, Bob, and Billy, right? You know, and a lot of people spent a lot of money to come to those three shows, and the band made a lot of money. And then, like, 3 months later, it was announced the Dead and Company would carry on with John Mayer in place. And
Who's doing really well, by the way.
He
John
is.
Mayer playing that guitar. He studied. He did his chops, and he's wonderful. Well,
my question to you is it appropriate that, first of all, they carry on after so-called final show? And what have you thought about the incarnations, these various splits and different performances?
Every band that I know is done, this is the last one. Whoops, 10 years later. Well, let's, yeah. And especially when they run out of money, they want to do it again. You know, as Bill Graham once said, it's not the money, it's the money!
Oh, so you have no problem with their carrying on?
No, not at all. I'm delighted.
Well, I like it. The part that I like, I just don't like that they called those Chicago shows the farewell shows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially the same band, except Trey's not in it. John is in it.
It's different.
But it's different, but it's not that different. And they're still using the name.
Yeah.
In other words, they said.
Well, they're mostly dead.
Okay.
Well, that would be a great name also.
Mostly dead.
Mostly dead.
Phil's not in it.
Well, Phil's not in it, but he's the only one that's not in it. So, I mean, it's essentially the same band without Phil, and John Mayer's on guitar, but they're calling it the Dead and Company. And it just struck me that if you're going to say we're done with these three Grateful Dead shows and then 3 months later go out as almost the same band without Phil and call it the Dead and Company, that there was a slight money grab to that. I don't know.
I just enjoy the music.
That's all that
counts. And if it's good, it's good music.
That's all that counts.
And if it's not good music, then it sucks, and I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Do you remember?
But meanwhile, it's really good.
Okay. I want to talk about Jerry for just a minute because you knew
Jerry.
Him. And what was he like? I never got to, well, actually, I interviewed him once, but I still never got the sense of exactly what he was like one-on-one.
Let me talk to you a little bit about the beginning of this charity that I've given my life to called Seva. Seva is a Sanskrit word that means service to humankind. And we work in curable and preventable blindness. 80% of the people in the world today that are blind could get their sight back with a simple operation that is the same as the price of a couple movies with friends. You could reach around the world and somebody could see. In our 39 years of doing this stuff, we've enabled 4 million people not to bump into stuff. They get their sight back.
Wow.
Now, it began in Heartlands, Michigan. We got a small grant from Steve Jobs to come together, the people in Larry Brilliant's Rolodex, together in Ram Dass, Danny Rifkin, the manager of the Grateful Dead at that time. The biggest show I ever did was with the Dead and the band for Seva in Toronto at Kingswood Auditorium. But okay, so every organization, righteous organization that start out, well, why don't we have a concert? Let's get the Rolling Stones or something like that. And they start to make the phone calls and they realize it's very, very difficult to get anybody to play for free. So my job was to go get the Grateful Dead to play for free for this charity. So I go to Detroit and I get on the plane. And who is on the plane but?
Grateful Dead.
Exactly.
The whole band?
The whole band.
On a commercial flight?
Without parachutes. So I started with the drummers. Mickey and Billy were pushover. Jerry was so sweet. His line is, might as well.
Wow. And that began Seva.
Absolutely. And the first show was at the Kaiser Auditorium in Oakland. And Bill was producing it. He didn't know it was a benefit. Why am I the last to find out these things? God damn it. I'm sitting backstage with Steve Parrish, who is Jerry's enormous, beautiful roadie. Jerry's on stage playing away, and Bill comes back there and slips me this note. And I open it up, and it's a check for $10,000 for Seva.
I said, wow.
Bill, why are you doing this? He says, because you did not hit on me, my friend.
Because you didn't pound him for the dough, he gave you the dough.
Exactly.
Wow. Legendary figure. I want to get to Bill in just a minute, but Jerry, your take on who he was, your experience of him. I think the last time you talked with him, you were talking about the art of a gentleman who made art out of logs.
Andy Goldsworthy.
Twigs, yeah.
Andy Goldsworthy. You must experience Andy Goldsworthy. He's got big, fat books. He takes nature, and that is his palette. Sticks and twigs and leaves and stitches them together, or walls, or... Oh. Now, if Donald Trump could get Andy Goldsworthy, I think the Mexicans and the Americans would both be delighted, because it would be so beautiful.
But in terms of Jerry, you're just, you know, a memory of him that really stands out,
he describes him. He's just such a twinkle. What a sweetie pie. Oh, God. I remember this big concert that Sunshine Daydream. The film, you must have seen the movie.
Yeah, yes? Yeah.
Okay. That was in Oregon, and it was really hot. So I had the idea of spraying the audience with water to cool them off because it was so hot. Jerry says, you're so benign, Wavy Gravy. What a sweet idea. And so we're out there on the truck ready to let go, and this little kid on the back says, this stuff smells like sewage.
Oh, my God.
And we actually almost sprayed the entire Grateful Dead audience with excrement, which would have been quite memorable.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's hysterical.
So we just said, Jerry was, he hurt himself. He was laughing so hard.
He seemed like he had a great sense of humor and very self-deprecating.
Absolutely. That's his, and really smart.
Yeah.
He knew all about, like Saba, the roots of Saba began with the eradication of smallpox, which is the first disease in the history of the world to be totally eradicated that killed millions of people every year. And Larry Brilliant ended up running the American team for smallpox eradication. Larry Brilliant is my best friend. And it came to pass that it was Larry's Rolodex that shook out and included my wife and I and Ram Dass. And
it started the whole thing.
Yeah.
Let's move on briefly. I know you got to get
onward,
going.
Upward, upward, to the edge of the edge and saw it off.
Because I wanted to be a concert promoter when I was a kid, and I went to every show that Bill put on. I went to Winterland. You know, I was at the Snack concert. I was at these events that had his touch. Speaking of art, he really was an artist. And to me, there's never been a concert promoter like him. There's a wonderful exhibit that's opened in San Francisco.
Yes,
and
it's
going
Jewish
to,
Museum.
Yeah,
it's a magnificent, magnificent show. And his son Alex, who went to Camp Winter Rainbow, he worked on it a lot, and his son David, and it's a magnificent, magnificent thing.
But what's your take on Bill Graham when you look back on him?
What's my Bill story?
Because I asked his son David, who went to college around here in New Hope, I asked him if he thought his father would have sold Bill Graham Presents to the national entity that now is Live Nation, and he said, I don't believe that he would have sold. Now, who knows?
I couldn't believe that Bill was dead. I thought he would kick death's ass. Get out. Eat it, death. Get out of here. I'm Bill. Don't mess with me. So we had to decide. We had a Grateful Dead show scheduled. Are we going to do the show? What would Bill do? Yes, we got to do the show. It's not the money. It's the money. So it was Halloween. So I decorated myself up as the
this
day.
This is after he died?
Yes, the day after.
Oh, okay.
We had a show.
The Dead had a show?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm trying to get this together.
And we were in charge of the children. But this side was Marin County, and this side was Oakland and Berkeley. And my teeth. This is.
You're showing your rainbow teeth again.
Yeah, my teeth were the Bay Bridge. So if any time people wanted to see my teeth, they had to give me a dollar.
Oh, my God.
So I had about $50. I was feeling really good when the ghost of Bill Graham came inside me and said, you schmuck, you should have made it the Golden Gate, because I would have gotten $3. So that is the essence of Bill.
Oh, God. Because he really
even in death.
He had the touch, though. I mean, he came out here and co-produced Live Aid out here. Mm-hmm. And backstage, it wasn't just, you know, a plastic tray with Cheese Whiz on Ritz crackers. It was this luxe. You know, there were couches and waterfalls and, mm-hmm. you know, palm trees. And he made it exotic. He was famous for those backstage areas. The idea being to make the artist more comfortable. They do a better show, makes the audience better.
When he did that, he was supposed to be the athletic director at Camp Winter Rainbow because he got busted taking some off the top of Grateful Dead money. So they had a trial, and Bill got sentenced to be the athletic director at Camp Winter Rainbow.
I can't imagine
that. But we cut him loose to do Live Aid.
Really?
Yes. Yes, that's the absolute truth, and I've never told anybody that. You never heard that, Mark.
Wow. Because I mean, he obviously, you know, he wanted his money, but on the other hand, there was nobody that put on a show like him, in my opinion. And there's been no one since.
And the artists knew that
he could be tough, you know, with the artists. He could be, you know, and he was legendary for his temper and his fights. And yet, the quality of the shows, the energy that would come around a Bill Graham show, whether it was The Last Waltz at Winterland, or the Snack concert, or Live Aid here in Philly. It was like an artist. There was a signature to it.
Next year, come to Gathering of the Vibes. I'll show you something. It's only 30,000 people, but it's as good as it gets for 30,000. I'm very, very proud of those shows. We've done them for about 15 years.
But what's
this year, we're taking a year off.
But in terms of Bill Graham, why do you mention that in the same breath as him?
Because it's so well done. It's so well done. And it's people that have studied at the altar of Bill and public assemblage, And the Barsotti brothers have taken a lot from that. We do an amazing event up in our ranch called the Kate Wolf Memorial Concert every year.
In terms of you know, where you see the world today, you know, you've done so much work. And actually, before that, let me ask you about Camp Winter Rainbow, because it's a wonderful thing that you do. Tell folks what it is.
Camp Winter Rainbow is a circus and performing arts camp that I've run for almost 50 years with my wife, Johanna Ra. We take kids from 7 to 14. 20% of the kids that are there are from economically challenged parents. Can I say that politically correct?
Certainly.
They come from shelters and, you know, very difficult situations, but 80% of the kids can very well afford to go. They learn juggling, tightrope, trapeze, tall stilts. Theater class goes from improv to Shakespeare.
Wow.
I used to teach improvisation at Columbia Pictures.
That's hard to believe.
Harrison Ford was one of my students.
Are you kidding?
No.
Wow.
Absolutely. I was part of an improvisational theater in San Francisco called The Committee, which is a world class for 15 years. We did Boff Spa, making stuff up about how crazy the Vietnam War was and what have you. But anyhow, kids learn that. They learn timing and balance and compassion. I call it survival in the 21st century, or how to duck with a sense of humor and love. And these are universal human beings that can deal with anything that comes down the pike as a dance, as a poem. And I'm so proud. People ask me, Wavy Gravy, what is your greatest legacy? And they expect me to say, Seva and 4 million people that aren't blind anymore. But I say no. It's the children who have come out of Camp Winter Rainbow that warm the cockles of this old clown's heart. And on a cold night, you want to have some warm cockles.
You still wear the clown nose, by the way.
Well, it gets nippy out, you know. You want to.
Why do you wear the clown nose?
For fun. It's just for fun. Okay. It used to illustrate back in the ancient times that that you were drunk. A clown is a poet who is also an orangutan.
Okay.
Is the definition of a clown by John Townsend, who wrote the Book of Clowns.
You also have visited a lot of sick kids in hospitals.
Absolutely. And why do I do these things? I'm in it for the buzz. It gets me off.
Well,
it makes me feel really good.
What we discover as humans is if we give something a little bit of ourselves, where you know one-on-one that it's made a difference, you feel so phenomenal by doing it.
Bingo. That's it. You got it. You got it. Blackout. Yeah. That's end of game. If everybody did that, we would be in heaven now. Good morning. We must be in heaven, man.
That's you again. Oh, my God.
Put your good where it'll do the most. Yeah, Kesey. When Kesey passed, Kesey was a great influence.
You speak
in
of
my
Ken
life.
Kesey.
Ken Kesey, the merry prankster, the guy who put the first bus on the road, wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion. I was in my room looking out at the street, and I saw all these TV trucks drive up with their big stuff on the roof. And I knew that somebody from my team had burst forth to the other side, shall we say. The sleep that rots. Patrick Henry's second choice. So I knew that something heavy was about to come up the stairs, and they came up. And they said that Kesey was dead, and what influence did he have on me? And I said, he gave me my family values.
Wow.
There was a thing that he and Paul Krasner came out with called The Last Supplement to the Whole Earth Catalog, and R. Crumb did the cover of The Last Supper, and it was a hilarious thing, but he had a thing in there, Jewels for My Chest, and he talked about Freddie Neil, and he talked about Neil Cassidy, and he talked about honoring your father and mother and the Bible. And I just got on the phone and called up my father and mother. They were blown away. And I thanked him. He said, well, it's so darn simple. And the phrase that he gave me that I pass on to the children always put your good where it'll do the most. And that's how I've lived my life. And I can't think of a better phrase to go out with.
You know, we've lost so many people in the last 6 to 8 months, you know, from David Bowie to Glenn Frey to, you know, recently Prince, Paul Kantner, Lemmy, you know, Scott Weiland of STP. It's put this mortality front and center. I don't know if it's a concern of yours or not, but what do you think happens when we leave this planet?
Only time will tell. I write haikus. When Kesey died, I said, they say Kesey's dead, but never trust a prankster, even underground. Now, what was I talking about? The one that I wrote for Muhammad Ali, I said, oh, say, can you see to free Muhammad Ali from Parkinson's jail? He was set free.
Yeah.
It was horrible what he was going through. It was a beautiful thing.
Do you think that there's a reincarnation or a heaven or a life on the other side?
It's very possible.
Well, ultimately, we never know until it happens, right? Until we cross.
You got to be there. But Paul and I were
Paul Kantner.
Well, no. Oh. I wrote a beautiful haiku for Paul that I don't remember. He was the author of Anthems, though.
Jefferson's Starship
Airplane.
That's
in there somewhere. Good grief. That's two words I got from Charlie Brown that enables me to deal with the sleep that rots a little better. It's good grief.
Well, you know, you've got to live in the moment. Last two questions I have for you. In terms of the bohemian and hippie spirit and that whole thing, how do you think it's best to keep it alive in 2016, in the present time?
Put your good will do the most. And the haiku that I wrote for Jerry, that Paul Simon fell off the couch when I told him, the fat man rocks out, hinges fall off heaven's door. Come on in, says Bill.
Wow. Last thing, you know, when the Woodstock era was happening and the protest marches against the Vietnam and young people were coming together in mass to try to have an impact, I do believe they were ultimately responsible for stopping that war by virtue of getting out in the streets. But it was more than that. It was this thing that we're going to change this whole world and make it a much more workable, peaceful place. Do you think the world was changed, is changed? Because one, a cynic could look at it and say, it's not, it's really a messed up place. But yet there's so much positive that's still out there. What is your take on if we really changed the world?
It's a slow, steady change, but it is changing. And
for the better, you mean?
Yeah, in my geezerhood, you know, as I'm 80. In 20 years, I'll be 100. Are you kidding?
That's awesome.
I didn't think I'd break 30.
So just by continuing to do good and staying positive.
Absolutely. And be kind to each other. What's her name? Ellen, what's her face, says that at the end of her show.
Ellen DeGeneres.
Yes. What a great idea. And you know who else says it? Joan Baez, who I just saw her 75th birthday special. You got to see it. They're running it on PBS. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing. And she is the real deal.
Final thing. The device you're walking around is like a cane, but it seems to be an instrument as well.
It's from India. It's an ektar. I play it upside down and backwards. I'll give you a few lines from my hit song, and wouldn't it be neat if the people that you meet had shoes upon their feet and something to eat? And wouldn't it be fine now if all humankind had shelter? Basic human needs, basic human deeds, doing what comes naturally down in the garden where no one is apart. Deep down in the garden of your heart. And wouldn't it be grand if we all lent a hand so each one could stand on a free piece of land? And wouldn't it be thrilling if folks stopped their killing and started in tilling the land, basic human needs? And it goes on. You have to come to the show tonight to hear the whole song. And it's in the movie. It closes the movie. And singing that song is Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown and Steve Earle and Taj Mahal and Bob Weir. And, yeah, a lot of greatness.
Can you just play that into the microphone, the instrument again, just because it's got such a vibe. Right in a little higher into the mic. Very cool. Just one note, right?
Basic humor. Well, yeah, but Jerry could do a slide on it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, if I had a glass or something.
That's all right. it is. It's just been such a pleasure to have you here. Our guest has been Wavy Gravy, and it's a weekend-long celebration called Unlimited Devotion. It includes an evening of goodness. This is this evening at the Mainline this evening at the Mainline Art Center in Haverford. Whee! And there'll be a meet and greet with Wavy. And Scott will be there with his extensive Grateful Dead poster collection as well. And I believe Splintered Sunlight, the Grateful Dead tribute band, will be playing. And then that gallery is also open for viewing the next day, which is tomorrow, Saturday, June 11th. And then Saturday morning at 11 a.m., the Bryn Mawr Film Institute is going to screen the film Wavy was just talking about, the Wavy Gravy movie.
It will blow your mind. It will absolutely blow your mind. I guarantee it.
And after that, Wavy will be there for questions and answers. And Michelle, who is the film's director, will be there as well. And then Saturday night at the Ardmore Music Hall, a benefit for the Rex Foundation, which the Grateful Dead established with all of these Terrapin All-Stars, including Phil Lesh's son, Graham, and many, many, many more, playing some Grateful Dead music. And that'll be a wonderful evening. So it's all fun. Where did we get the tickets for the art thing?
So it's Unlimited Devotion, one word, .eventbrite.com. And then the tickets for Ardmore Music Hall are at the Ardmore Music Hall website.
Okay, that's ardmoremusichall.com. And for the theater, the Bryn Mawr Film Institute?
You can walk up. It's at the Bryn Mawr Film Institute at 11 a.m., and we will be selling tickets at the door. Okay. And that's on Lancaster Avenue in Bryn Mawr.
Yeah, you can't miss it. Beautifully restored theater. Wavy Gravy, 1,000 thanks for spending some time with us.
Back at you. You've got a great show here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's WMMR. We've been here for 48 years. We're heading towards our 50th. You've hit your 80th, and may we all rock on.
Eternity now.
Thank you, sir.
You have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, hippie icon, flower geezer, and temple of accumulated air. And you are listening to Pierre Robert at 93.3 WMMR. It rocks!
Oh my God, that's so cool!
Could you do one more for our overnight DJ, Jackie Bam Bam? And he says he's a full-time vampire. He does the overnight shows. We're one of the few stations that has a live overnight person, Jackie Bam Bam.
This is Wavy Gravy, activist clown and former frozen dessert. And you are listening to Jackie Bam Bam at 93.3 WMMR and rocks.
Oh, my God, that's perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much.